We would like to send out a special thanks to our new sponsor, Warby Parker, for supporting The Trail Went Cold. They provide boutique-quality, stylish eyewear and sunglasses at revolutionary prices. You can try them for yourself by going to warbyparker.com/cold to order your free home try-on kit with free shipping all around. That's warbyparker.com/cold. That's warbyparker.com/, and be sure to type lowercase COLD. Enjoy the show. August 18th, 1949. Los Angeles, California. 48-year-old widowed socialite Mimi Boomhauer finishes a phone call to one of her friends, but is not heard from for the next few days. When police check Mimi's house, they discover that her lights are still on, an uneaten salad is sitting on the table, and her car is still parked in the garage, but she has vanished without explanation. Her purse is soon found inside a phone booth, containing an anonymous message that was found on a beach. Even though Mimi was suffering from financial problems, and had told her business manager she was planning to meet a man on the evening she went missing, no motive or suspects are uncovered for her disappearance. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we've got ourselves an old missing persons case to cover today, the 1949 disappearance of Mimi Boomhauer. And I'm just going to say this up front. Yes, the reason this case caught my attention in the first place is because of her last name. As you probably know, the name Boomhauer is most associated with the fast-talking redneck character from the animated TV series King of the Hill, and since I'm sure that's the first thing that popped into your head when you saw the title of this episode, I thought I'd get it out of the way immediately. All that being said, once I started delving into this case, it turned out to be quite a compelling mystery. I'm surprised it's not more well known, but one of the reasons might be that it was soon overshadowed by a more famous missing persons case, which took place in Los Angeles less than 2 months later, the disappearance of actress Jean Spangler. Curiously enough, in both these cases, the victim's purse would show up days later. Mimi Boomhauer's disappearance is one of those eerie mysteries where a person just vanishes without explanation from their home, and even though there's no indication that they were planning to go anywhere, there's no hard evidence of foul play either. While there are a number of compelling angles and potential theories in Mimi's case, none of the pieces fit together, and the investigation was unable to uncover any solid suspects. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is finally on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the mysterious disappearance of Mimi Boomhauer. Our story begins in Los Angeles in 1949. Our central figure is 48-year-old Mimi Boomhauer, who happens to be the widowed heiress of wealthy linoleum tycoon Novice Boomhauer. The couple were married for 13 years, before Novice passed away on August 17, 1943. Novice was also notable for being a prominent big-game hunter with a large trophy collection, and Mimi often accompanied him on his safaris to Africa. The couple never had any children, so Mimi currently lives alone in their luxurious 10-room mansion on Nimes Road in Bel Air. On the evening of August 18th, the day after the 6-year anniversary of her husband's death, Mimi received a phone call at home from a friend of hers to discuss an upcoming social event, and the call ended at around 8 p.m. Earlier that day, Mimi had spoken with her business manager and told him she was planning to meet a quote-unquote gentleman that night, but did not tell him who this man was or what the meeting was for. Mimi told her manager that she would call him at 8:30 p.m., but she never did, and no one would ever hear from her again. Over the course of the next few days, many people attempted to phone Mimi at home, but she didn't answer the phone. One of them was her friend, Stella Hunter, who Mimi was supposed to have dinner with before she canceled at the last minute. There are contradictory accounts of when this was supposed to take place, as some sources state that Mimi was planning to have dinner with Stella on August the 18th, the same night she disappeared, while others state that it was actually the previous night, August the 17th. Personally, I think the 17th is the correct date, but either way, Stella became concerned when she could not reach her friend. Mimi was a very prominent socialite, who was scheduled to appear at many social engagements after the 18th, but she failed to show up for any of them, and never contacted anyone to cancel. While some of Mimi's friends figured she might have just left on a trip, it was very uncharacteristic of her to do something like this without notifying anyone. A neighbor of Mimi's noticed that the lights were on in her house, but even after she attempted to phone Mimi, knocked on her door, and even threw some pebbles at her window, there was no response. Finally, on August the 21st, Stella Hunter and a male friend of Mimi's decided to contact the police and accompanied a detective to her house. Even though the front door was locked, the detective used a passkey to enter. Mimi was nowhere to be found inside her house, but the circumstances left everyone baffled. The house's lights were still on, and an uneaten salad was resting on the dining room table. A dress was also laid out on Mimi's bed, which seemed to indicate that she had changed her clothes shortly before she disappeared. Her locked car was still parked in the garage, so none of the evidence seemed to suggest she had planned on leaving. The house was dusted for fingerprints, but the only ones which could be found belonged to Mimi. There were no signs of robbery, though Mimi did often wear many items of valuable jewelry, including a diamond breastpin, a diamond-encrusted bracelet, and 2 diamond rings. Combined, this jewelry was valued at approximately $25,000, but was never found, so it was assumed that Mimi had been wearing it at the time she went missing. One curious clue was a postcard which was found in Mimi's mailbox. It was postmarked from Long Island, read, "Olga gave me your news," and was signed, "Lillian." While Mimi did have a sister named Olga who lived in Long Island, but she had no idea what the postcard was referring to, and neither Olga nor anyone else in Mimi's life had any idea who Lillian was. One detail which stuck out was the fact that every single light in the house was left on, including a string of backyard lights, which she wouldn't have had much need to use if she was indoors. This led to speculation that if Mimi was being kidnapped, perhaps she may have frantically switched on all those lights in an attempt to signal that something was wrong. The last time Mimi was confirmed to be alive was during her phone call with her friend, which ended at around 8 p.m. on the evening of August 18th. Since Mimi had promised to call her business manager at 8:30, but never did, it was theorized that she went missing during this narrow window of time. An interesting lead was provided by Mimi's gardener, who claimed that in the week prior to her disappearance, he remembered seeing a middle-aged man with white hair, who was parked in an expensive car in the driveway next door. He appeared to be watching Mimi's house, but the man was never identified and did not reappear after Mimi went missing. A few days before she vanished, Mimi had gone to see her furrier to order some fur coats, but made an odd remark. She told him that she couldn't place an order yet because she needed to discuss it with her husband. However, Mimi then quickly corrected herself and said she meant to say she needed to discuss it with her family, but either way, the remark came across as odd. Mimi had 3 brothers and 2 sisters, but they all lived far away, and she never needed to discuss any of her purchases with them. Regardless, the husband comment made some people wonder if there was any significance to the fact that Mimi disappeared the day after the 6-year anniversary of her husband's death. Since she had told her business manager that she was planning to meet a gentleman on the evening of her disappearance, one possible theory was that Mimi had decided to elope and run off with someone. However, this seemed uncharacteristic of Mimi, and her friends and family did not believe she would have taken off without telling anyone. Ever since Novice's death, Mimi had dated a number of different men, but never entered any serious relationships or expressed much interest in ever getting remarried. But there was another potential motive for Mimi to want to disappear voluntarily. In spite of her wealthy appearance, she was experiencing financial problems at that time. Earlier that year, Mimi had taken out a $5,000 home equity loan in hopes of opening up a new business for the manufacture of folding wooden furniture, but this business never came to fruition. Mimi was in the midst of attempting to sell her mansion, but even though it was worth $75,000, she put it on the market for only $65,000 and was willing to sell it at a loss. Another sign of Mimi's possible financial desperation was the fact that she had recently pawned a $3,000 watch for only $100 and was considering pawning off some of her other jewelry. She was also trying to sell her furniture and her husband's large collection of big game trophies valued at around $300,000, but was doing so at a fraction of the item's value. Months later, one of Novice's elephant heads would be sold off, only for the buyer to discover that the tusks were made up of 175 pounds of plaster. Unbeknownst to anyone, it seemed like Mimi had already sold off the tusk's ivory on a previous occasion. All that being said, in spite of her financial issues, Mimi was not bankrupt at this point, and still had a number of financial assets, including the $25,000 worth of diamond jewelry she always wore. Investigators explored the possibility that perhaps Mimi's financial problems or grief over the anniversary of her husband's death might have compelled her to commit suicide, but they cannot uncover any evidence to support this theory. Mimi had given off no visible signs of being depressed, and was known among her social circle for being a very fun-loving person. In fact, this had earned her the nickname the Merry Widow, a moniker the newspapers would often use to refer to Mimi while covering her disappearance. One clue which seemed to go against the idea that Mimi was planning to commit suicide was that 3 days before she vanished, she placed an order for 2 packages of Christmas cards which had her name imprinted on them. There would be another interesting development on August 24th when a white calfskin purse was found inside a phone booth at a supermarket on Wilshire Boulevard, located only a few miles from Mimi's home. The purse was established as belonging to Mimi, as it contained many of her personal possessions, including her driver's license, credit card, car keys and house keys, as well as her compact and lipstick. However, it did not contain any of Mimi's missing jewelry, and the only money inside was a torn $1 bill. A message had also been scrawled on the side of the purse in black ink, which read, "Police Department, we found this at beach Thursday night." Of course, Thursday night was the last time Mimi was seen, but investigators were skeptical that the purse had been found on a beach, as there were no particles of sand or traces of salt water found on it. The case got even stranger on August 29th, when a Los Angeles County Superior Court judge declared Mimi legally dead. Needless to say, declaring a missing person dead after they've only been gone 11 days is highly irregular, and at the time, California state law required a person be missing at least 90 days before this could take place. Well, much to the police's chagrin, the judge decided to waive this rule so that Mimi's attorney could access her accounts and administer her estate. The attorney used Mimi's money to keep paying off her home equity loan so the bank wouldn't foreclose on her house, and many of her possessions were sold off to help pay her debts. 3 months later, the same judge announced that he had made a mistake and decided to reverse his ruling. It would be 7 more years before Mimi would be declared legally dead for good, and her estate was divided up among her siblings. By this point, debts and legal fees had reduced the value of Mimi's estate by more than 2/3. The closest the police ever got to a suspect was a Las Vegas club operator and convicted dope peddler named Thomas Ellery Evans. Evans was heavily involved in gambling, and once ran a casino on a gambling ship operated by notorious bootlegger Tony the Hat Cornero. An informant told police he had seen Evans having drinks with Mimi Boomhauer in the cocktail lounge of the Roosevelt Hotel on August 18th, the same night she disappeared. There were also unconfirmed rumors that Mimi had been approached by a quote-unquote scar-faced man who inquired about renting her mansion to turn it into a gambling casino, which she refused to do, though it's unclear if this scar-faced man was supposed to be Evans or not. Regardless, Evans was questioned by police, and while he confirmed that he was at the Roosevelt's Cocktail Lounge on the evening of August 18th, that's because he frequented the place virtually every night. He denied knowing Mimi, and said that if he had drinks with a woman there on that particular night, it wasn't her. In the end, investigators never found any evidence that Evans even knew Mimi, let alone had a hand in her disappearance. But here's an odd footnote to Evans. In the intro, I mentioned the famous disappearance of 26-year-old actress Jean Spangler, who went missing after leaving her Los Angeles home on October 7th, less than 2 months after Mimi vanished. Much like in Mimi's case, Jean's purse turned up, as it would be discovered in Griffith Park, so police looked into the possibility that the two disappearances might be connected. While one of the people they wound up questioning in regards to Jean's disappearance was Thomas Ellery Evans, who was being held on suspicion of robbery by that point. But once again, they found nothing to indicate that Evans might have been involved. Anyway, the investigation reached a standstill, but after Mimi was declared legally dead in 1956, her sister Olga and her husband publicly expressed their own theory about what might have happened to her. They suspected Mimi may have been targeted because of the expensive jewelry she wore and may have been abducted and murdered by someone who was posing as a prospective homebuyer. But after nearly 70 years, no one has ever uncovered any evidence which points to a particular theory or suspect, so the circumstances surrounding the disappearance of Mimi Boomhauer continue to remain unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to express our thanks to Warby Parker, as we are very excited that they are now supporting our podcast. Warby Parker makes high-quality, stylish, and affordable glasses that start at only $95, including prescription lenses. In addition, their lenses include anti-glare and anti-scratch coatings. And for every pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker also distributes a pair of glasses to someone in need. Warby Parker makes buying glasses online easy and risk-free with their Home Try-On program. The Home Try-On program allows you to order 5 pairs of glasses shipped directly to your door, where you can try them on in the comfort of your own home, which allows you to receive feedback from friends, family, and colleagues about how they look. You can keep the frames for 5 days before sending them back for free using the prepaid return shipping label with no obligation to purchase. After you head to warbyparker.com/cold and place your Home Try-On order, make sure to download the Warby Parker app from the iTunes App Store. They built their awesome Home Try-On Companion feature for the app, which allows you to quickly take photos wearing all the frames, stitch it into a video, and share with friends and family to help you pick a winner. Anyway, before I found Warby Parker, it had been a long time since I purchased a new pair of glasses. I won't say exactly how long, but let's just say that podcasts were not even a thing at that time. I guess it was because I just didn't feel like going to the trouble of visiting a store to browse new frames. But thanks to Warby Parker and their Home Try-On feature, I was able to select a few frames that I liked and have them sent directly to me. There were so many great frames to choose from, and one of the most convenient things about the app was getting to show these frames to friends and family beforehand in order to get their feedback about which ones they liked. It's much simpler than bringing everyone to a store with me so they can watch me try them on. Some of my favorite frames which caught my attention and compelled me to try them on included the Hardy, the Crane, and the Eaton, but I eventually settled on the brown-colored Oliver style because everyone I showed them to thought they were a perfect fit for me. Warby Parker is absolutely the best, most convenient resource you can use for getting a new pair of glasses. So to try Warby Parker out for yourself and see how good you look in their frames, go to warbyparker.com/cold to order your own free home try-on kit with free shipping all around. That's warbyparker.com/cold. WarbyParker/, and be sure to type lowercase COLD. And if you have an iPhone X, be sure to download the Warby Parker app and try their new Find Your Fit feature. The app measures key facial features through the phone's true depth camera and suggests which Warby Parker frames best fit your face. And it certainly made the right selection for me. So thank you and enjoy the rest of the episode. So this is definitely a strange mystery with a number of potential theories about what might have happened, but no conclusive evidence to support any of them. For years, the Los Angeles media referred to this case as the disappearance of the Merry Widow, and I'm surprised it's not more well known today. Then again, there are a number of famous unsolved mysteries involving female victims which took place in LA during the late 1940s, so I can see why this one would be overshadowed. I hate to say this, but a lot of the newspaper articles from that time period were not too flattering about describing Mimi's appearance, as many of them flat out described her as quote-unquote plump, and in one anniversary article, they actually wrote, quote, she was not quite tall enough and a little too stout to be considered beautiful. Ouch! Given what a beautiful young woman Jean Spangler was, I guess I shouldn't be too shocked that she grabbed all the headlines away from Mimi when she disappeared several weeks later. Well, now I'm going to have to discuss a possible connection between this case and the most infamous unsolved crime which took place during this time period, the Black Dahlia murder. As I'm sure you're well aware, the mutilated body of 22-year-old Elizabeth Short was discovered in a vacant lot in Los Angeles's Limerick Park neighborhood in January of 1947. Not surprisingly, it's been theorized that the same person who murdered Elizabeth Short might have also been responsible for Jean Spangler's disappearance, since both victims were attractive dark-haired women in their 20s who were attempting to launch an acting career. Of course, a 48-year-old widowed socialite like Mimi Boomhauer does not exactly fit the same profile, but she has also been looked at as a possible victim of the Black Dahlia killer. If you follow that case, you might be familiar with Steve Hodell, a former Los Angeles homicide detective who believes that his deceased father, George Hodell, murdered Elizabeth Short and has published a series of books about the subject. Unfortunately, Steve Hodell has also accused his father of being the Zodiac Killer, which has weakened his credibility in many people's eyes, but that's a whole other can of worms. Nonetheless, Hodell has referenced Mimi Boomhauer's disappearance in his books, and even got a certified document examiner named Hannah McFarland to study a photograph of Mimi's purse and perform a forensic analysis of the handwritten message left on there, which, as you recall, read, Police Department, we found this at beach Thursday night. A week and a half after Elizabeth Short's body was found, the Los Angeles Examiner newspaper received a handwritten note which read, here it is, turning in Wednesday, January 29th, 10 a.m., had my fun at police, and was signed, The Black Dahlia Avenger. Of course, the writer never did turn themselves in, but instead sent another note stating they had changed their mind. Well, according to Steve Hodell's books, Hannah McFarland compared the handwriting on the Black Dahlia Avenger letters to the block printing of the message found on Mimi Boomhauer's purse, and concluded that it was, quote-unquote, highly probable they were a match. In his eyes, the message was scrawled on Mimi's purse by the Black Dahlia killer, aka his father, George Hodell, who lived only 7 miles away from Mimi's residence in 1949. Well, I don't buy it. I'm not going to go into a detailed analysis about whether I believe George Hodell was the Black Dahlia killer, because that's a whole other topic. But I have my doubts that the same person who murdered Elizabeth Short was responsible for Mimi Boomhauer's disappearance. The main reason I don't believe Elizabeth's death was connected to any of the unsolved missing persons cases from that time period is because the Black Dahlia murder was such a public spectacle. This was one of the most brutal, graphic crimes in the history of the United States, which is why it's still talked about over 70 years later, and the killer left the victim's remains out in the open for everyone to see. If this same person murdered Mimi Boomhauer, or Jean Spangler for that matter, then I don't know why they would completely dispose of their remains and leave behind no evidence that a murder had taken place. I really don't like Steve Hodell's choice of words in his book, as he wrote, quote, Hannah McFarlane's forensic analysis of the handwriting on Boomhauer's purse irrefutably connects George Hodel to the kidnap and murder of Mimi Boomhauer. Not to downgrade McFarlane's work or anything, but she was making her analysis based on a photograph of the handwriting on Mimi's purse, rather than the actual purse itself. I've looked at the photos and compared the handwriting, and while I could certainly see the similarities, I hardly think it's quote-unquote irrefutable proof that the author was the same person and that Mimi was murdered by the Black Dahlia killer. So I really do not believe Mimi's case has any connection to the Black Dahlia or the disappearance of Jean Spangler, though there is one more lesser-known Los Angeles cold case from this time period I'd like to explore. On February 16, 1948, a 42-year-old real estate agent named Gladys Kern was found stabbed to death with a hunting knife in an empty Los Feliz mansion which she had been attempting to sell. The apparent motive was robbery, as Gladys's diamond-studded watch was missing, and while our killer was never identified, it's believed that he posed as a prospective buyer in order to lure Gladys there. Since some people have theorized that Mimi was also murdered by someone who pretended to be a prospective home buyer in order to steal her jewelry, there's always a possibility these two cases might be connected, but that doesn't explain why the same killer would go to the trouble of disposing of Mimi's body while making no attempt to cover up Gladys Kern's murder. Since we don't really have any solid suspects in this case, I guess we should start off by going over the potential scenarios. I think it's pretty much a given that Mimi was the victim of foul play, and that she did not commit suicide or disappear voluntarily. Given Mimi's financial problems at the time, suicide is not a completely implausible option, but no body has ever been found. Sure, I guess she could have jumped into a body of water somewhere, or taken her own life in an isolated rural area, but since her car was left behind in her garage, how would she have traveled to these locations to begin with? They checked the local taxi cab companies, but there was no record of a cab ever showing up at Mimi's house that night. Running off in order to escape her financial issues and start over is not an implausible scenario either, especially since she was wearing around $25,000 worth of jewelry when she disappeared, which is the equivalent of around $265,000 today. But still, it's not like that's the type of money you can live on for the rest of your life, and Mimi had already pawned off some of her jewelry and gotten less money for it than it was worth. It sounds like Mimi could have avoided financial ruin by simply downgrading her lifestyle a little bit, which is why she was attempting to sell her house. Even though it was being sold at a loss, Mimi still could have gotten around $60,000 for it, which is money she would have found very useful if she wanted to disappear and start a new life. I think that if Mimi wanted to run away, she probably would have ensured that her car and many of her other valuables were sold off at first, so she'd have as much money in her pocket as possible. Now, it is pretty odd that a judge was willing to declare Mimi dead only 11 days after she went missing in order to ensure that her estate could be administered to. This made me wonder if Mimi's estate might have provided a potential motive for her disappearance, but I doubt it. As irregular as this situation was, I don't think anyone had Mimi murdered for the purposes of inheriting her estate, because after all her debts were paid off and legal fees taken care of, it doesn't look like there was that much left. I've never suspected Mimi's siblings at all, but the one clue I've never been able to get a handle on is the card found in Mimi's mailbox from someone named Lillian, who wrote, "Olga told me the news," even though neither Olga nor anyone else in Mimi's life seemed to have any clue who this Lillian was. Given that Mimi was a very prominent socialite, it's possible that she did know someone named Lillian whom her other friends weren't aware of, but it is strange that this Lillian would make mention of Olga if they didn't actually know each other. If Lillian existed, that might be one hint that Mimi had a secret life no one knew about, but it doesn't look like this lead ever went anywhere. I should also address the conversation Mimi had with her furrier a few days before her disappearance, as it seems like it has been interpreted in different ways. The official story is that when Mimi attempted to order some furs, she said she needed to discuss it with her husband, but then corrected herself and said she needed to discuss it with her family. Under normal circumstances, I'd say that wasn't anything more than a slip of the tongue and that we shouldn't read too much into it. However, some of the original newspaper articles state that Mimi specifically used the words "present husband," which, if true, makes me look at this conversation in a different light. Some people seem to have interpreted that as Mimi accidentally letting it slip that she had secretly gotten remarried without anyone's knowledge. After all, it's not like Mimi ever had to discuss her purchases with her family before she placed any orders, so why would she have said that unless she really needed to correct herself? If Mimi really did get secretly married to someone prior to her disappearance, then this totally changes the complexion of this case, but it doesn't look like the investigation ever uncovered any evidence that this had occurred. Still, when you consider that Mimi had told her manager she was planning to meet a gentleman on the night she went missing, then it's very tempting to believe that she might have had a secret spouse. But let's back up and examine all the events which led up to Mimi's disappearance. We know that she had canceled the dinner date with her friend, Stella Hunter, though like I mentioned earlier, there is contradictory information about whether this was supposed to take place on the evening of August 18th, or the previous night, the 17th. This is a very important detail, because if it was the 18th, then this would imply that she had made plans with someone else, presumably the gentleman she told her business manager about. However, I'm inclined to think the dinner with Stella was supposed to take place on the 17th, which would make sense since that was the exact 6-year anniversary of the death of Mimi's husband, and I could see her wanting to have dinner with her best friend, what I assumed was a difficult day for her. But this begs the question, if the dinner date was on the 17th, what prompted Mimi to cancel it? Because if there's one thing which might compel Mimi to cancel on her best friend, it would be spending the evening with another man. At first glance, it really doesn't look like Mimi had any major plans for the evening of the 18th, as she appeared to be sitting down to eat a salad and told her business manager she was planning to call him at 8:30. Or at least, she wasn't planning to go out anywhere, but since Mimi mentioned meeting with a gentleman, it's reasonable to assume that he was coming to see her at the house. Since a dress was found laid out on Mimi's bed, this would imply that she had recently changed her clothes, but no one seems to know what exact clothing she was wearing at the time she went missing. If a man was visiting Mimi at home, then her choice of clothing could potentially answer the question about whether their meeting was business or personal. However, I'm inclined to think it was business-related, and that this meeting was supposed to be brief. It's always been suspected that Mimi's disappearance occurred sometime between when she finished her last call at 8 p.m., and when she planned to call her manager at 8:30, and I'm not sure why she would be making that call if she had a date scheduled. Even though this case garnered a lot of publicity in the papers, no man ever came forward to inform police that they met or planned to meet with Mimi on the evening of August 18th, so I think it's reasonable to assume that this gentleman she referred to was involved. But who was the perpetrator, how did these events transpire, and what was the motive? Of course, the closest this case got to a potential suspect was Thomas Ellery Evans, who is definitely a shady figure, but the only connection is a tip from an informant who thought they saw him with Mimi at a cocktail lounge that night. Given that Evans was a regular patron at that bar, it's possible the informant might have simply seen him with another woman resembling Mimi that night, but it wasn't actually her. If Mimi had planned on going out with someone, I don't see why she would have left all the lights on at her house and had an uneaten salad on the dining room table. I still think the most logical explanation is that Mimi was planning on meeting a man who showed an interest in buying her house, and that the reason she told her manager she was going to call him that night was to tell him how the meeting went. Under the guise of being a prospective buyer, this man convinced Mimi to let him into the house, and he used that as an opportunity to abduct her. She was subsequently murdered at another location before her body was disposed of. I previously made mention of the unsolved murder of real estate agent Gladys Kern, which took place in Los Angeles the previous year, presumably after she was lured to an empty house by someone who showed an interest in buying the place before he proceeded to rob and kill her. I'm not necessarily saying that the same person who murdered Gladys was also responsible for Mimi's disappearance, but there are many documented murders in which the perpetrator went through the charade of pretending to be an interesting homebuyer in order to get themselves inside a house alone with a vulnerable woman. In fact, one reason I'm inclined to believe the same person wasn't responsible for both crimes is because whoever murdered Gladys left her body out in the open, whereas whoever murdered Mimi went to the trouble of hiding her body. We have the report from Mimi's gardener that he saw an unidentified white-haired man parked next door staring at the house in the week prior to his disappearance. While the authorities thought this may have just been a real estate agent scoping the house because he hoped to sell it, it's also possible that this person was scoping Mimi in order to conjure up a plan to get along with her inside the house. The primary motive which has been pushed around in regards to Mimi's disappearance is the $25,000 worth of jewelry she always liked to wear. That jewelry was never found, but it's reasonable to assume that Mimi had it on her at the time she vanished. In spite of her financial difficulties, it seems like Mimi always made it a point to wear the jewelry because it gave off an impression of wealth, but I know there was concern that it could have made her a target, especially for someone who managed to get into her house under the guise of being a prospective homebuyer. Robbery is the most logical motive, but there are still a few things which make me wonder if there's more to this crime. For one thing, even though Mimi was wearing expensive jewelry and her purse was taken, it doesn't sound like anything else was stolen from the house, even though she likely kept other valuables there. And there's also the odd fact that even though the lights were left on in the house, and the evidence seemed to indicate that Mimi was abducted, the front door was locked. Unless the perpetrator entered and exited the house from some other spot, would they really go to the trouble of locking the door behind them? Well, this brings up another potential theory that Mimi was not forcibly abducted from her house, but threatened into accompanying someone. While there was never any evidence that Thomas Ellery Evans played any role in Mimi's disappearance, he was involved in gambling, and I've always been intrigued by the possibility that perhaps Mimi's financial issues were the result of a gambling problem. If she had gotten herself into debt with people who were associated with organized crime, then she may have reached the point where she was in so far over her head that she was forced to put her house up for sale and pawn off her valuables in order to pay them back. Hell, the surprise revelation that the ivory from the tusks on her husband's elephant head was gone and had been replaced by plaster is a sign that Mimi may have been really desperate for money at some point and was now going so far as to defraud another buyer in order to get more cash. Of course, this is all just speculation, as no one has ever uncovered any evidence that Mimi had a gambling problem or was in debt to some criminal figures, but I'm not entirely sure what the main source of all her financial problems really was. If Mimi did owe money to some bad people, I guess I could see a situation where someone showed up at her house on the evening of August 18th and ordered her to come with them. This meant Mimi would have walked out of her house willingly with her captors, but was still able to lock the front door behind her. She may have left the lights on accidentally, but it also could have been on purpose in order to send out a signal that something was wrong. Mimi then accompanied her captors to another location, where they subsequently did her harm. So the last big clue in this story is the sudden reappearance of Mimi's purse in the phone booth 6 days after she was last seen. The message written on it, "Police Department, we found this at beach Thursday night," was supposed to give off the impression that some innocent bystander found the purse and decided to turn it in without going to the trouble of contacting the police, but I highly doubt that's what happened. I think it's a given that whoever left the purse there and wrote that message was directly involved in Mimi's disappearance. For starters, even though Mimi's ID and credit cards were found in the purse, there was no money inside except a torn $1 bill, and there's a good chance that the rest of her money was stolen. Since there were no traces of sand or salt water on the purse, it seems unlikely that it was found on a beach. And if they really did find it on Thursday night the 18th, why was it not discovered in the phone booth until 6 days later? I seriously doubt it would have been in the phone booth that entire time. It does seem bizarre that the perpetrator would decide to return Mimi's purse, as people might have been more inclined to believe she took off voluntarily if the purse was never found. I suppose someone might have wanted to create the false impression that Mimi could have dropped the purse on the beach before walking into the ocean to drown herself and commit suicide, but otherwise, I'm guessing they may have just done this to taunt people. I previously expressed my doubts that the message on the purse was written by the author of the Black Dahlia Avenger letter, but here's one more reason I don't think they're the same person. Whoever wrote the Black Dahlia Avenger note wanted people to think they were the killer, whereas whoever wrote the message on Mimi's purse wanted to give off the impression that they were nothing more than some random citizen who found the item and wanted to turn it in. But whoever was responsible for this, they left no evidence about what might have happened to Mimi. Even though there is no solid suspect in this case, I think the best candidate might be the unidentified white-haired man who was seen watching Mimi's house while parked in the next driveway. At the time, it seems like investigators were leaning towards the idea that it might have been a realtor who was just scoping the house and that he had no involvement in what happened, but his actions would also fit the theory about the perpetrator posing as an interested home buyer in order to gain access to the house and commit a robbery and murder. If the white-haired man was responsible, then he would have known the place was for sale and may have been scouting it in order to plan his crime. He could have seen Mimi and noticed she was wearing a lot of expensive jewelry and figured she would make an ideal target, especially since she lived alone and was completely vulnerable. But it's also possible that robbery wasn't even the motive at all, and the killer was just obsessed with Mimi herself. If he simply wanted to steal her jewelry, he could have just murdered her inside the house and taken them, but the fact that he went to the trouble of abducting Mimi suggests he had something else in mind. I am inclined to think the crime was committed by someone who was a stranger to Mimi, but there's one final possibility. If in fact there is some significance to Mimi telling her furrier that she had to discuss things with her quote-unquote present husband, and she was involved in a secret relationship with another man, then that person has to be the perpetrator. Perhaps it was a man who entered into a quickie marriage with Mimi because of her wealth, but when he found out she had financial problems and wasn't nearly as rich as she appeared, he decided to kill her. But until some solid proof can be found that Mimi was involved with someone, I'd say the crime being committed by a stranger posing as a home buyer is the most logical theory. Whoever the perpetrator was, they essentially got away with the perfect crime, since they didn't leave anything behind which implicated them, and they managed to stay off the radar for nearly 70 years. I have my doubts that this case has any tangible connection to the Black Dahlia murder or the disappearance of Jean Spangler, and if those famous crimes had not taken place in Los Angeles during this exact time period, then the unsolved disappearance of the Merry Widow might be a more well-known mystery. As it is, it's still a pretty baffling one, and after all these years, there's very little chance of it being solved, since whoever might have had knowledge about what happened is probably long dead. All that being said, should you happen to have any information on the disappearance of Mimi Boomhauer, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've released some exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this month, we're releasing the audio of my appearance at the Canadian Crime Podcast event in Toronto last month, so to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum. I need to provide my thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes our eerie music score. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶